We are learning how to keep our food scraps and yard waste out of landfills. It's an hour of composting advice here on The Morning Show. I'm Kate Archer-Kent. So Vermont has become the first state to enact a mandatory composting law that went into effect this month. Organic food scraps are banned from landfills throughout that state. Do you have a backyard garden? Or if you don't, do you still want to save your food scraps for someone else's compost? Are you wondering about all the food you scrape off your dinner plates and into the trash? If you compost, what's in your pile? How's it doing? We're at 800-642-1234. Kate Nelson is the Chief Sustainability Officer at UW-Milwaukee, where she's responsible for planning and managing a variety of sustainability initiatives, including energy conservation strategies, recycling programs, and urban gardening. Kate, welcome to the Ideas Network.
Good morning. Thank you for having me.
Well, before we dive into composting, how are you coping through this pandemic at UW-Milwaukee?
I think we're coping pretty well. It's not been easy. Sustainability is all about adaptation, so I think myself and my staff are doing pretty well. Waste is down, but now it's showing up probably at people's houses. waste is diverted, yes, it has moved. But we are doing very well and taking all the precautions and safety measures for returning in a hybrid form in the fall.
I understand you're still able to look after the campus garden these past few months. How is that going?
Yes, we have several different types of gardens and that we've built over the last 10 years. And so we decided early on in March to divert all of them to growing food just for our food pantry on campus. And so myself and one of my staff members are handling about 1,500 square feet on campus right now, but all that food has been going to the UWM Food Center and Pantry.
Is the campus food pantry open year-round?
Yes, it is. And right now, they do have limited hours, a little bit different strategy, of course, and so they're open on Thursdays.
What are you harvesting?
Right now, we have a lot of leaf lettuce. Some radishes got rather large on us. Spinach.
That's not always bad.
No, it kind of took us by surprise. Let's see. Kale, definitely. And I hope next week that the summer squash is finally ready.
And so do you have students or how do you manage all these gardens?
It's not typical to just be myself. I do have one student staff member who's been with me for over a year. She also manages our compost operation year-round. So it's really just her and I. I have a little bit of help from other staff. Our restaurant operations at UWM has helped us in the kitchen prepare the food as well.
My guess is those gardens get a healthy offering of compost.
They do. That is our goal. We are self-sustaining on our compost operations that fulfill. We have rental gardens for faculty, staff, and students, and we have a shared area that has been devoted to different programs, like used to run a high school urban agriculture jobs program. We actually have a brew garden that is focused on our fermentation studies. So we hope always to supply the compost we need for our gardens on campus.
We're talking with Kate Nelson, Chief Sustainability Officer at UW-Milwaukee, getting at your questions about composting this hour. Do you compost? What does your compost pile include? Is it outdoors? Where is it? Join in 800-642-1234. Let's bring in a question now. Richard is joining us from Two Rivers. Hi, Richard. Oh, and Richard is not there. Richard has some compost bins that he put together and is wondering if you're allowed to add things like corn on the cob or if that takes too long to break down.
Corn on the cob. We don't get a lot of whole cobs at UWM, but it is a vegetable or a fruit. We typically handle pre-cooked food waste. And so I only have an understanding of the pre-cooked. So if you scrape that corn off, and have put the cob into the pile, that's fine. We often find, too, that there are bigger items. Pineapple heads tend to be one of those that stick around. A good idea is to sift your compost. So if you're adding things like corn on the cob, pineapple tops, wood chips is our carbon source mostly, we sift things out at the end, and then you have this very beautiful, rich pile where everything is a medium texture.
Richard, are you there?
Yeah, I'm here.
Oh, good, good. Did that get at your question about corn on the cob?
Yeah, it did. And it's like, and it was like other things too. And how many times should you turn it? Once every couple of days? How much dirt you put on? You add to it? But yeah, no, that's fine.
Richard, have you started a compost pile?
Yeah, I started. I'm putting the other bin together, which you got to be a brain surgeon. But the second one's going a little easier. But yeah.
Kate, would you have any suggestions for Richard, who is starting out?
So the simplicity of compost is that organic matter will break down. So don't worry too much about all the individual, too much of the science right away. Get your food scraps pre-cooked into a pile and add a carbon source. So that could be wood chips, straw, shredded paper. And you want to turn your pile, if you're doing hot compost, which is a great idea if you really want a good product, you need to turn it at least once a week. And you want it to reach 140 degrees at least.
Do you pop a thermometer in there? How can you tell?
Yeah. Yes, there are such things as compost thermometers. They're about 2 feet long. Our piles on campus tend to be about a cubic yard. We have a lot more of them, I'm sure, than at home. But just simply a pile that you are adding to, you want to add your carbon and nitrogen sources at the same time. So anytime you add nitrogen, add some carbon. And turn it about once a week. And, yeah, get one of those really awesome compost thermometers. They're kind of fun.
So when you turn the pile, how do you know that you have done it effectively? Because that can kind of be a chore.
Yeah, you sort of convert to muscle energy when you're making compost. We tend to put a tarp out. We turn the entire pile onto the tarp, and then we turn it all back. We also sometimes add drainage tile to run throughout the pile that has holes in it. So then there's constant aeration. You want oxygen to reach your pile.
You know, how much of a pile should you start with if you want more of like entry level and don't want to commit too much at the beginning?
Start wherever you're comfortable. Even a little bit can go a long way. If you're really looking for that organic fertilizer in the spring when you're getting your plants ready, then you want to take a more active approach. If you're really just looking to divert food scraps from the landfill, you're already doing a really good thing. So it all depends on your objective.
We're learning how to make rich compost that our plants will love with Kate Nelson as our guide. She's UW Milwaukee's Chief Sustainability Officer. Do you chop up your food scraps before you put them in your compost? Do you live in a place without much space for composting? How have you made it work? What makes a good compost bin, and how do you put it together? Bring your compost questions and your compost wins at 800-642-1234. Email ideas at WPR.org. We'll be back in just a minute. Stay with us. Kate Nelson is here on the Ideas Network. If you're just joining us, we're talking about the composting process here on The Morning Show. I'm Kate Archer-Kent. It is the sustainable way to dispose of kitchen scraps and yard waste, and it makes nutrient-rich soil that our plants appreciate. What problems have you encountered in your compost pile? Have you achieved the right balance of soft greens to brown, woody material like the cardboard and the dead leaves we were talking about? Is your compost slimy or attracting flies? Bring your compost situation. We'll work through at 800-642-1234. Kate Nelson is here. She is Chief Sustainability Officer at UW-Milwaukee. She's our guide to composting. So, Kate, what is the timeline for letting compost cure? How long does it take?
After the pile has reached a hot temperature up to 160 degrees, you would then leave your compost be. We call it curing. At UWM, we tend to let it cure for about 6 to 7 months.
So 6 to 7 months, and then what do you do after that?
So you want to check the temperature again, and you would like it to be just generally the temperature of the outside. You no longer want it to be hot. Otherwise, your nitrogen is still active and the pile is still active. Then it's ready to go. Then you can use it as an additive to your gardens, your flower pots. You can also make compost tea. That's not to drink. So essentially, you've created this beautiful, rich, organic fertilizer for all of your growing needs. And quite frankly, it's really a wonderful thing to stick your hand into a new pile of freshly made compost. It feels like quite an achievement.
Well, now you've tantalized us here. What is in this compost tea?
Oh, so, well, there's many different prescriptions online. I have been using a 5-gallon bucket. I add water and about 2 cups of the compost that I just made. And I also add, I think, a tablespoon or two of molasses. So it's not really a tea, it's a brew. The molasses is, of course, a sugar that is a food source for the bacteria in your compost. And so you let that, you mix it up and you let it sit for about 24 hours, I think up to 36 hours. If you've gone past that, you probably have an inactive tea, so you want to use it when it's ready. And then you water your plants with it.
How do your plants do? What have you seen?
They're going to be greener. They'll produce more fruit. I mean, there's so many different factors, as we all know as gardeners, how things grow, but it's giving it a little bit of the organic fertilizer as it keeps growing that might have been used up, especially if you're growing in pots.
Do you have any suggestions for compost bins? Because Richard was saying the one he's trying to put together is pretty complicated.
You know, it's kind of funny. I have used compost bins before. I tend to really just love a pile, and I know that that's not ideal for every yard and every area. You need to be able to access it. You need to be able to turn it. You need, like I said, that muscle power. You got to get in there. And if it's difficult, you're not going to want to do it. So whatever encourages you to access it. I also have some in my yard. They're pickle barrels that you can spin on a pivot. And those are really nice because I can just walk through the yard and turn it really quickly. They are kind of onerous. So I really do just advise a pile. You feel like you can see what's going on. You tend to have a better idea of the mixture that you've put in, and you keep an eye on it.
And on campus, don't your bins have the ability to where you can pull down the sides a little bit?
Yeah, we actually, we operate just in piles. We put a pallet between each pile,
okay.
And we number them because we're keeping track of the dates and the temperatures for each pile, slightly scientific for us. We need a good product. But we actually have our piles in what we call a hoop house. So that's that plastic covering. They tend to look like greenhouses. The chipmunks keep us from using it as a greenhouse. But the piles then heat up, and it really helps us do a year-round operation. You know, it's a lot warmer. You go in there in January and it just smells like fresh earth, and you can like taste the activity going on when winter is so frozen and you usually don't have access to that. So We like the hoop house idea. That's kind of unique to us. It gives us a mid-range you know, we're bigger than a house, but we're not industrial either. So it gives us that great space to work in the winter, and it kind of warms you up.
We're talking with Kate Nelson, who works at UW-Milwaukee as Chief Sustainability Officer, managing, maintaining on-campus gardens and composting. She's fielding your questions about composting through the hour. Do you participate in a community garden where you live? Do you use compost? Where do you get your scraps from? What's in your local garden? Join in at 800-642-1234. We heard from Brenda in Spring Green, couldn't stay with us. Brenda has a barrel composter, has noticed there are a lot of smaller insects in there. Some look like fruit flies, maybe other creepy crawly things. And Brenda isn't sure about what's going on in there with those flies.
That's very natural. You created a wonderful habitat for those insects. You created that network of nutrient exchange. So you're going to have fungi, you're going to have bacteria, you're going to have worms and bugs and things like that. I mean, it's a problem if you would be doing it inside, course. But if she's doing it outside, that's just part of the process and it's nothing to worry about.
Let's talk about the things to keep out of your compost pile. What would those be?
Definitely any meat or dairy. That would be the number one thing. Bread. You're really looking for, if you're doing this at home, you're looking for pre-cooked food scraps. So we add the watermelon rinds, onion peels, things like that, things that have gone bad. So all of a sudden you have that guilt of like, oh, my potatoes went bad again. Put those in your compost pile and you'll feel much better. So we you can also add eggshells. That's a calcium source that a lot of gardeners love. You can also add coffee grounds, but you don't want that to take over too much. You really want that pure nitrogen source. You can also add fresh mowed grass. That's a green when it's first cut. So you really just want to think about pre-cooked. If you go with that, you're good, because the temperatures that you're creating in your environment are only hot enough to kill the disease pathogens and the bacteria at that temperature. And if you're putting meat or dairy or bread, cooked things in there, you can't guarantee that you're able to break it down properly.
Rewind to the coffee grounds for a moment, because I'm concerned about the acid and, maybe putting too much in there, because there is a lot of coffee grounds at our house. what should we do about that?
I don't know the perfect ratio, but okay. we keep it at a minimum. It's only one element, but we definitely have a lot more greens. I don't want to say what the right amount is, but you definitely don't want to just do coffee grounds. You need some other things, but a lot of plants like that acid. So if you're a gardener who's been doing things for a while, you might be more familiar with what you like to grow. Blueberries is a perfect example I can think of that like acidic soil. So compost tends to help balance the pH in your soil. If you're adding that to a lot of other things, you should be just fine.
I wonder, would it be okay at all if a plant does love acid to add a bit of those grounds directly to the soil around the plant as like a mulch?
I've tried it. It didn't work for me, but
okay.
I think someone else might do it better. The compost tea might be a really good idea. Maybe you want to give it compost tea more often, because then that saturation allows it to help break down.
Will the tea bag itself break down?
I don't use a tea bag. I just stir it up with a really big spoon and then dish it out.
In terms of the cups and the plates and the bowls that sometimes end up in the wrong place, how do you approach that?
That is perhaps one of the biggest issues in the composting industry. So we talk about zero waste. We try to move away from fossil fuel plastics, which is a really good thing. But we're still having the single-use items. So a big movement in the last 10 years was to use compostable wares. That's the term that we tend to use to cover those bowls and plates. There's compostable cups that are made. But essentially, there's some research coming out that they leak PFAS, that's PFA or perfluoroalkyl or polyfluoroalkyl.
The forever chemical, yeah.
Yeah, so that's getting into our waterways because there's a lot of things that go into those compostable wares. They actually test them up at UW Stevens Point. And that's become a huge part of where we have to stop things in the industry. So we started using a lot of them, and we, you know, you feel better about that. You think you're doing a good thing, but we have to remember the science and what is actually happening. So there's a big halt on compostable wares and putting them in our compost piles.
Kate Nelson is our guide to the compost pile. She manages sustainability initiatives at UW-Milwaukee. What do you do with your eggshells and watermelon rinds? What changes have you noticed in your plants after you've added compost to the soil? What do you want to know about compost bins? Have you started a compost pile, and now what? Join in at every stage, 800-642-1234. We'll pick this up with Kate Nelson right after a news update here on the Ideas Network. Each year, we throw away more than 25% of all the food produced in America. That's according to the Agriculture Department. And we're learning how to compost our kitchen scraps here on The Morning Show. I'm Kate Archer-Kent. Do you have a kitchen compost collector or a small bin with a cover where you put your carrot trimmings and your apple cores and all that? Do you cut up the things you put in your compost pile? What questions do you have about things to avoid adding to the pile? And how do you handle your tea coffee grounds? Join in right now, 800-642-1234. Kate Nelson is our compost guide this hour. She's working in sustainability at UW-Milwaukee. So, Kate, let's talk about small spaces, maybe people in apartment living who don't have access to a backyard. Can you compost indoors?
You can. I know there are several different units on the market, some that use worms, some that don't. I've even seen one coming out that looks more like a dishwasher, so it kind of takes the guesswork out of it and make your compost. But also remember, if you're collecting those food scraps, that valuable resource, there might be a community organization or a garden that can also take them. So if you're willing to drop them off, we even take some from faculty, staff, and students at UWM if they put in the right items. But there's also places around the community that you can drop off.
Beth in Waukesha, I think, is wanting to get at that question. Hi, Beth.
Hi. Thanks for taking my call. I live in a condo for about a year now, and I used to... When I was married, we had a beautiful one that compost bin that my husband built in the backyard, and it was perfect and, you know, really convenient and stuff. But now in the condo, I don't have access to any kind of composting. I'm just wondering if there's any such thing as a community compost.
That's a great question. I am less familiar with Waukesha. So there's an organization in southeastern Wisconsin. There's Compost Kids. And there's Compost Crusaders, which has built up into more an industrial size. And so really part of this is the engagement. I always find when you're changing lifestyles, you're looking into sustainability, who else out there is also interested? So maybe your condo association wants to collectively have a bin together. Of course, I don't know what kind of rules and things like that you need to follow. But also Compost Crusader, they collect in Milwaukee, so they actually have bins for food waste. You opt in to it. And I'm not quite sure, but I wonder if Waukesha would also be interested in that. Otherwise, look into something small that you can do indoors. I'm sure there are a lot of options. I know it gets tricky, but... sometimes you're not going to be able to make the compost yourself, and you can opt into working with your community. And sometimes that takes someone like you, Beth, to start that up. And it's much more fun to learn together on gardening and composting.
Beth, thanks so much for the call and the question. You know, Kate, I've been looking at those under kitchen sink compost holders, if you will. If we want to put something under the sink so it's easy to kind of store up our compost, what would you suggest?
Anything that has a tight lid, and some of them have a carbon filter. It can help keep the smell down. And in our office, we put it in the freezer. So then we know we never have any issue with bugs or with smell. It's kind of funny, but it works for us. We didn't need fruit flies floating through our group meetings. So you can do that. Also, without too much of a plug, I mean, you can use an incinerator. So in Milwaukee, when you grind your food scraps, they go through the plumbing system, and MMSD actually is able to harness that as energy. So the incinerator, I believe that's made in southeastern Wisconsin. There are probably other models. It's basically your garbage disposal. And in Milwaukee, that actually helps MMSD generate energy.
Oh, wow. So your garbage disposal is the holding area for the scraps?
So it's breaking it down into your plumbing and your water system.
Uh-huh.
And then MMSD is able to
capture it.
Yeah. So you should probably talk to someone from MMSD. I don't want to sound like too much of an expert on that, but there is a debate, you know, because compost does let off methane. And is it better to send it through the plumbing system and allow the sewage district to collect that gas? Or is it better to compost it in your yard? And I think you always have to think about your objective. What are you trying to achieve? And if it's simply to divert your food scraps, you have a lot of options. If you're trying to really get that good fertilizer, you want to figure out how to do it at home.
We're talking with Kate Nelson, Chief Sustainability Officer at UW-Milwaukee, spending the hour learning how to compost, how to do it in our backyards, indoors as well. Are you an environmentalist? What are the benefits of composting? What should we know? And who taught you to compost? Join in at 800-642-1234. Kate, do you ever notice any critters around your compost piles? And should we just let it be, or you know, should we be concerned about those things that want to get into the compost?
Don't be concerned. I heard a good quote recently that if your garden is not part of the ecosystem, then you're doing it wrong. So I think I would transfer that over to compost piles as well. We have all kinds of critters, and because we have the enclosure of the hoop house, we get startled from time to time when an opossum shows up. but they're all part of the system. Composting is putting the system in front of you. Usually things go away, and you are now taking that responsibility to handle your waste, your scraps yourself. And so the system changes. And chipmunks and squirrels and birds, they're all part of that system. You don't want to find anything that's dangerous. Thankfully, I haven't walked in on a raccoon or anything like that. But we almost joke that our compost piles with the drainage tile running through them, we call it the chipmunk playground. You know, they're running around, they're having a good time. And of course, then we don't try to grow anything in there either. But yeah, that's just part of the system. And if you are worried, there are enclosures. You sometimes will tarp a pile to keep the fruit flies down and things like that. But we've been doing this for about 6 years, and I can only remember one summer where the fruit flies were bad. So it hasn't created too much of a problem. You can always, if you want to slow down your compost, you don't turn it, you don't add water, and that might reduce some of the activity. But honestly, you want to make sure that compost pile is active so that you get a good product.
If you never turn your compost, what would happen?
It would break down slowly. It's, you know, you can be a lazy composter. It's a thing. So that's called cold composting usually. So you have to be more conscious of what you're putting in it. You don't want to put any weeds that have gone to seed and things like that, because you're going to have a harder time breaking down those elements. You don't, of course, want to add more weeds to your garden. We all know how hard that is already. So that's just the lazy way, but it works too, and it just takes more time.
Let's bring in Jessica now in Reedsburg. Hi, Jessica.
Hi. This is such a great topic. Thank you so much for bringing this up. I was actually this morning just reading in the New York Times an article about dry composting that's popular in Japan. But the reason I called was your guest had mentioned that composting produced methane. But actually, in truth, it doesn't really produce methane because it's an aerobic process, unlike landfills, which are anaerobic and produce a lot of methane. And that's what makes composting so great for the environment. And that's why we need more people to get involved in composting to help reduce this greenhouse gas, methane.
Jessica, thank you so much. Do you compost?
Yes, I do. Actually, I'm here on vacation. I live in London, and in our borough of Hackney, we compost, and our local government picks it up, and they compost all of our food scraps for us, and they use it for the city parks and gardens.
That is incredibly efficient. Kate, how does that sound?
It sounds wonderful. You know, composting is a system, and when you scale it up, you have to get more entities involved, whether it be, you know, your city, your government, and things like that, or a business or a community group. We're producing a lot of food scraps. We're producing a lot of waste. And so sometimes we can't handle all that in our backyard, especially if you're usually cooking with fresh food. So that's wonderful. And the city of Milwaukee has been active in that. We need more people to opt in to that kind of idea.
Let's bring in Paris now in Muskego. Hi, Paris.
Hi, can you guys hear me?
Yes.
Hi, I just wanted to share a comment. So we live in Muskego, and we used to live in Indianapolis about 5-6 years ago. And we had found a service in Indianapolis that if you don't compost on your own, there was a small business that would come out to your house and collect your organic waste. And then they would compost, and then they would sell it to local restaurants and farmers. And we've actually found that here as well. So if anyone's interested, if they can't compost on their own or they don't want to, you can Google Compost MKE. It's a small business here in Milwaukee area. And they will the person will come out to your house, collect your organic waste for a small fee, compost it himself, and then, you know, send it to the community.
Oh, Paris, thank you so much for the tip. That's Compost MKE. We have Kate Nelson, Chief Sustainability Officer at UW-Milwaukee, taking your questions about composting. What do you want to know? Who taught you how to compost? What did they convey to you? And what have you learned about your compost pile over the years and how you use it in your garden? Still time to talk. 800-642-1234. We'll be back in a minute with Kate Nelson here on the Ideas Network. We're into composting here on The Morning Show. I'm Kate Archer-Kent. So have you perfected the art and science of turning your garbage into rich soil? Why are you passionate about composting? Have you reaped the benefits of garden gold, as they say? How do you monitor the moisture content of your compost pile? Still time to share, 800-642-1234. We have Kate Nelson here. She works in sustainability at UW-Milwaukee, and she stays with us. Let's bring in Katrina now, joining us from Grand Chute. Hi, Katrina. Hi, Katrina. Oh, are you there, Katrina? And I think we can't hear her, but Katrina says Katrina's dad used to put seaweed in compost. How does seaweed and algae change compost is Katrina's question.
Ooh, that's a new one for me. I mean, it's a very rich nitrogen source. So you might need a little more carbon to balance it. You're always looking for a 2-to-1 carbon to nitrogen balance. So it might be a very nitrogen rich product. I wow, I'd love to see if we could get some seaweed into our compost pile. That's really interesting. Depending on where you live, right? We all have different nitrogen sources around us.
Katrina, I'm going to try you one more time. Are you there?
Yes, thank you.
Oh, good. Yeah. So have you tried seaweed in compost? How did it work?
Well, I just have memories of my dad, and we lived near Lake Winnebago, and he had great faith in adding it, especially when he was planting sweet corn. That's all I know.
Well, thank you for sharing that. And Kate, I want to circle back to what Paris had been saying about compost MKE that picks up your scraps at your house for a fee. Have you seen that working?
Well,
for me?
Yeah, Kate. Uh-huh.
There is a lot of folks out there researching and really trying to understand the distribution system of composting, and it's a tough business. So I think that this really speaks to the research and development that is needed for the system. Is it a cost benefit to be able to do that? How far do you go to collect it? How many people do we need out there? Because essentially you're using fossil fuels to go out and get those scraps. You have to remember that. So what is the right size system, and how do we create, I guess you would call it more like wheel spokes for collection sites, the balance between people bringing their own scraps somewhere versus being picked up? And that's a really important part. I think during the pandemic, we've seen the disruptions in food distribution, and the same thing could be said for composting. What is the right balance to create a business or a community organization, or if it is your government, who can help pick up, and how do you find that balance? We also need people then buying compost. And this gets confusing. Aren't we using compost as a noun and a verb in the beginning and the final stages? But essentially, is anyone going to be buying or using that product? And I think that's part of the system, and we need to see more people thinking to use a natural fertilizer like that just as much as we need folks collecting their food scraps to add to the pile.
So here in the height of summer, your gardens are just going crazy, radishes and all. How are you using your compost?
So we add it in the beginning. We fill our beds with it every year. We have several different types of garden beds and areas. So we start with it in the beginning, and then when we're replanting, so we tend to get the spinach and the lettuce every 6 to 7 weeks, and we just replanted about half our beds. So we add a little bit of compost into the top inch as we seed for that. So, or then if you're at home and you're just getting one crop out of your garden, you can make the compost tea to add to your gardens or your flower pots.
Are there any other concoctions, if you will, that you have intrigued you that you can mix up with your compost?
Yeah, I think, you know, anything that if you're making the compost tea, it's any kind of sugar element that the bacteria are going to go for. I'm trying, like fish kelp, I guess that goes to the seaweed concept that was just brought up. You know, we should be learning from the past. You said her grandfather. There's a lot of rich information from 50 to 100 years ago that we seem to have forgotten that's out there. I'm not really sure. I recommend Mike, the worm guy. He knows a lot about the chemistry and the kind of concoctions that you can make up. He was very helpful to our gardens, and we also worked with an MPS high school, and he helped us get out there with the kids and learn more about those additives.
Well, Kate, thank you for joining us.
Yes, thank you very much. It's great to have a program like this. I hope everybody tries doing zero waste imperfectly, and then we all achieve something great together.
Kate Nelson is Chief Sustainability Officer at UW Milwaukee. If you missed any portion of this conversation on composting, you can stream it at wpr.org/mornings. COVID-19 is like nothing we've seen in more than a century, but the idea that a new virus could threaten the lives of millions around the globe is something public health officials have been thinking about and warning against for decades. As Rob Mentzer reports, some are now seeing their pandemic plans put to the test.
14 years ago, the health officer in Marathon County spent the better part of a year creating a pandemic preparedness plan. Back then, a pandemic didn't seem like something that would actually happen, not even for Julie Willems Van Dyke, who wrote the plan. But she believed in being prepared. So in April of 2006, she gathered with health officials, law enforcement, and local media in Wausau for an exercise. How would they respond if someday there were a real pandemic?
It's a brand new virus.
The media preparedness briefing.
Wisconsin Public Radio's Glenn Moberg reported on the meeting.
Marathon County's health officer, Julie Willems Van Dyke, said in a pandemic, no one would be safe.
In a pandemic, the germ has mutated or changed and it's brand new and no one in the world has immunity to it.
Willems Van Dyke shared some best practices.
Especially before there's vaccine, stay home. The less contact you have with other people, the lower likelihood you're going to come in contact with someone who's sick.
Some of those phrases that I used in 2006, I've used every day since this pandemic erupted.
In 2019, Willems Van Dyke became the Deputy Secretary of Wisconsin's Department of Health Services. There's something surreal, even to her, about the abstract way they discussed a possible pandemic a decade and a half ago. She says the public health advice holds up. But
it's very different in real life than it is when you're doing a tabletop exercise.
Very few people alive today have experienced a pandemic on the scale of COVID-19 before, but it is something many saw coming.
Some of the narrative has been, was like, wow, we couldn't really anticipate this. No, I mean, people very much anticipated this.
Jennifer Nuzzo is an epidemiologist at Johns Hopkins University. In September, she was lead author on a report that warned that global health systems were not prepared for a pandemic respiratory virus. That turned out to be true. Nuzzo says it's not just that the federal government didn't anticipate the pandemic. Leaders failed to listen even after the pandemic began, even today.
The case numbers now are higher than they've ever been. So now, and we very much know how challenging this virus is. We have had now multiple months of living with the horrors of this virus, and we're still not acting.
One thing that very few plans contemplated was just how politicized public health measures would become. Brad Karger was Marathon County Administrator in 2006. He was Willems Van Dyke's boss then, and he worked with her on the preparedness plan. Did you consider the political aspects of it?
I have a simple answer to that. No, we had no clue. I think we're naive. You know, nothing like shutting down the economy had ever been tried in our life experience.
In early June, when the disease was declining in Wisconsin, Willems Van Dyke cautioned that the pandemic was not over.
I am haunted by the disease curves I see from the Spanish influenza pandemic of 100 years ago that had a spike in the spring, a quiet summer, and the most deadly spike in the fall.
But the June decline didn't last, and the summer hasn't been quiet. Wisconsin has seen a surge in new cases, setting daily records for new infections. Health officials say we still have a chance to make changes that will slow the spread of the disease, and they hope some changes will be permanent, like better attention to hygiene, social acceptance of mask wearing, and staying home when we get sick. Rob Mentzer, Wisconsin Public Radio.
This is The Morning Show. I'm Kate Archer-Kent, and you're listening to the Ideas Network.